This is our last geography of the Old Testament class, and I just want to tell you, I've said it before, but thank you for being such troopers. I know this is a different approach, and sometimes you can come in on Wednesday nights and you're like, first time I sat down all day in a good seat, you know, that kind of thing. So, but I appreciate your willingness to jump in and try these things, and I think that they help us to further entrench in our understanding this world, and that when we read the Bible, that we're stepping into that world, and it's real to us, and the people are real to us, and as a result, it has the impact that God wants it to have. The Bible is a book that you read and you study, but it's also a book you experience. It's not like some dry instruction manual. It is just laced with flavor and color, isn't it? So thank you for participating in these with me. So let's start with prayer. And Les, can you start us off, please, by going to God?
Lord, we are so grateful for another day, for the blessings of each and every day that we enjoy, the provisions you make for us each and every day, and for our lives, and especially for this local congregation that is privileged to gather together and study your word on Wednesday night. Thank you for the time together. Pray that you'd be with Philip. Help us all to learn more and to give you the credit and glory for every good thing that comes from it. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
So, last week we spoke of three mighty kingdoms at the end of the Old Testament that God was using. And one way that you can help your understanding of these kingdoms is to think about them geographically. We actually spent quite a bit of time talking about these kingdoms a couple years ago when we studied through and read through the prophets of the Old Testament, because the prophets are writing to the backdrop of what God is doing with these kingdoms. So first of all, there's the Assyrian Empire. How did God use Assyria at the end of the Old Testament?
Judgment of Israel.
Judgment of Israel, the northern kingdom. And they invaded and they toppled Samaria, the chief city. And what did they do with the residents of Israel? Dispersed them throughout their empire, to where the northern kingdom never again reconstituted. And then God used the Babylonian Empire. Babylon was an old city going all the way back to Genesis days, but it had a resurgence. And like all these other ancient empires, most of these others, it's a city-state that then expands into an empire. How did God use Babylon? Babylon, you can almost, it's the consistently, Syria comes along, then the next one, Babylon, topples Assyria. Okay? All these kingdoms we'll talk about, the next one topples the one before, conquers them, or somehow subdues them in some fashion. And Babylon does that with Assyria. And how did God use Babylon? Then to attack Judah, invade Judah, destroy Jerusalem. And what did Babylon do with the people, most of the people of Judah that survived, as well as Benjamin and Simeon that had been absorbed? They took them into captivity and they kept them together. And so they kept their identity. And then how did God use the Persian Empire, which was one of the biggest ever?
Jerusalem.
I tried to send back the Jews, allow the Jews to go back if they wanted to. And by the way, best evidence would indicate most did not go back. They stayed in that Babylonian area. But a remnant went back and rebuilt Jerusalem, rebuilt the temple, and reconstituted themselves in Judah. And that's why, as you're coming into this intertestamental period between Old and New Testaments that we're going to talk about tonight, and into the New Testament, this area is called Judea. And the people who live there are typically not called Israelites. They're called what?
Jews.
So that brings us through those three kingdoms that we talked about last week. Well, there are two more kingdoms that are appearing on the horizon at the end of the Old Testament, but they're on the horizon. They're just beyond the historical record of the Old Testament, but the prophets see them coming. In particular, Daniel does. And so these are two kingdoms that emerge in this period between the Old and New Testaments. Anybody know about how many years between the Old and New Testament? 400 years. It's a long time. The United States, as a political entity, is coming up, is coming up on here, how many years? 250. 400. That's another 150 years. So that's a long period of time, and a lot happens. And I will say this to you, I'll just go ahead and get it out of the way. The history of what happens in the lands of the Bible between Old and New Testament, it's a complex history. And I'm just going to admit to you, it's not one of my strengths. And there's a good reason why it's not one of my strengths. I haven't read enough about it. Duh. But even that, it's a very complex history. There's a lot of characters, a lot of movement, a lot of people involved. And so I'm going to try to simplify it tonight because my understanding is simple about it. So I want you to look with me at two statements found in the book of Daniel. So turn to Daniel chapter 2. Who is Daniel? One of the captives of Judah that's taken to Babylon in the first wave. There are three waves of captives taken to Babylon. He's taken among the early ones, and these are the ones that are of the royal family and the talented and the elite, and he's one of them. He gets to Babylon. He has all these challenges. He ends up serving in the royal court. Nebuchadnezzar is the king of Babylon, and Nebuchadnezzar, man, he was powerful. He was a fantastic administrator, a very effective conqueror. He is top of the world, okay, that part of the world. And he has this vision that completely rattles him in Daniel 2. What's the vision? All right, this image or the statue, and it is composed of what?
Different metals,
gold, silver, bronze, iron, and even clay. And so several different metals there. And look here in Daniel 2, verse 36 to 45. Can you read that for us, Ray Conies? Daniel 2, 36 to 45.
This was the dream. Now we will tell the king its interpretation. You, O king, the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, and the might, and the glory, and into whose hand he has given, wherever they dwell, the children of man, the beasts of the field, and the birds of the heavens, making you rule over them all. You are the head of gold. Another kingdom inferior to you shall arise after you, and yet a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. And there shall be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, because iron breaks to pieces and shatters all things. And like iron that crushes, it shall break and crush all these. And as you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom. But some of the firmness of iron shall be in it, just as you saw iron mixed with the soft clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly iron and partly clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly brittle. As you saw the iron mixed with soft clay, so they will mix with one another in marriage. But they will not hold together, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall the kingdom be left to another people. It shall break in pieces all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever. Just as you saw that a stone was cut from a mountain by no human hand, and that it broke in pieces the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold. A great God has made known to the king what shall be after this. The dream is certain, and its interpretation sure.
Thank you very much. We have a marker here, because the first kingdom that's referenced, Daniel clearly identifies it as what? Kingdom Nebuchadnezzar, the first kingdom, the gold, head of gold. It's Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, it's Babylon. You're that king. So that's our marker, our starting point. And the way that this unfolds, he describes the subsequent kingdoms are not little states. They're not little, you know, kingdoms. These are mighty, significant, noteworthy kingdoms of the variety of Babylon. That's how this is portrayed here. And we know in history that what follows Babylon is Persia, because they're the ones that gives the order. They are the ones that give the orders for the Jews to go back if they so be they want to do that. And then we know the next kingdom after that, because they clashed with Persia, was the Greek kingdom. More on that later tonight. And then following the Greeks, because their kingdoms that were broken up into kingdoms were conquered by the Romans. And we also have another marker, because it's in the days of that fourth kingdom that God's going to do what?
Set up a kingdom
that's eternal. This is messianic. This is all through the prophets that the Messiah would rule over an everlasting kingdom. That was the inception of the idea of the Messiah in 2 Samuel 7 when God told David, he promised David that I'll raise up your seed after you, your son after you, to set on a kingdom forever. This is messianic. And so we have a time frame there from Babylon to Rome. And this takes us from the end of the Old Testament through the intertestamental period to the beginning of the New Testament and the New Testament period with the Roman Empire. And to further see this, I want you to flip over to Daniel 8. This is after the Babylonians have been conquered by the Persians, and Daniel is continuing to serve in the court of the Persian king. And he has a vision, and I just want you to glance at verse 2 to 8. He has a vision of what in verse 2 down to verse 8? First, he sees what?
A ram.
A great ram, okay? And then he sees what?
A goat.
And what does this ram and goat do?
They clash.
They battle. And who wins? The goat does. And that goat has this, his goat became exceedingly great, verse 8, but when he was strong, the great horn, he had a big horn, was broken. Okay? So here are two empires, and it's the goat that comes along and has a mighty ruler, but soon after this clash, that mighty ruler falls. Well, we don't have to squeeze anything out of this. We're told by Daniel in verse 20 to 22. Rick, read those verses, please. 20 to 22.
The ram which you saw with the two horns represents the kings of Media and Persia. And the shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece. And the large horn that is between his eyes is the first king. And the broken horn and the four horns that arose in his place represent four kingdoms which will arise from his nation, although not with his power.
Okay. Very clear here. The ram is who? Medes and Persians. And the goat who? Names it. Names of Greece, okay? Greeks have been around a long time, by the way. Some kind of flavor of Greeks have been around ever since around probably the time of David. But something happens. They get this one ruler, and he is something else. But he doesn't last long, according to this prophecy. And he's replaced by four kings that aren't as powerful as he is. So, here we're told about Persia, and we're told about Greece, and this is talking about Alexander. We're going to get into detail about that in just a few minutes. So here's what I want you to see. Again, it's this, you know, focus, this scope thing. We were so focused for so long in the Old Testament narrative and on Israel, but now it's expanding. And it's expanding, the scope is with these empires, with Babylon, with Persia, with eventually the Greek Empire and the Roman Empire. And here's why the prophet Daniel has a vision of these. And there are other prophets that have some visions about some of these too, but Daniel's are very pronounced. These kingdoms or empires were in vision because they would play a role in the plan of God. This is why what we're doing is very unique. You can zip down the road here and go up to UNCA and enroll in an ancient history class, and you can study about these people, Persians and the Greeks and the Romans and Babylonians and Assyrians and so forth. But there's one thing you're not going to get. I mean, you'll get a lot of great stuff. You won't get the real reason why they existed. This is why they existed. Because this is the divine account of their rise, their use, and their fall. Even their wide, expansive land empires were all brought about by God for His purposes in His plan. So, these two we haven't talked about here, the Greeks and the Romans, and that's what we're going to do. I'm going to give you some notes. You got a place on the back side for these if you're inclined to do that. I'm going to give you some notes and talk about the Greeks and the Romans and how the Greeks and the Romans impact the Bible lands. Who's there? Who's ruling them? What's happening in those biblical territories that we've been talking about? The Fertile Crescent area, Eastern Mediterranean, and of course, what we know is Canaan, then Israel. And then as we're getting into this Roman period, they started calling it Palestine, which we still call it today. All these years later, 2,000 years later, we call that strip of land Palestine. So I'm going to give you a quick flyover here with the Greeks. Now, you may know this if you're a fan of this time in history and you like these movies they've done over the decades, actually. Persia and Greece began to clash. Persia was an old, advanced, sophisticated empire, and they started to expand westward, and they conquered what we would call today Turkey or Asia Minor. They had it, and they were eyeing Greece. And let me tell you what the Persians thought of the Greeks. They were uncouth and backward. That's what the Persians thought of the Greeks. And they attempted to invade Greece several times by land and by sea, and they failed every single time. And there's some incredible battles, the kinds of battles that they make movies about. And they've done that. Hollywood's made a lot of money off the Persians and the Greeks. Okay? The Greeks were a very unusual people. The Greeks shared a culture, but they were not united politically. They were made up of these city-states that controlled the area around the city-state. Places like Sparta and Athens are the most famous ones. They were very independent. Sometimes there was a king over the city-state. Sometimes it was a group of wealthy people that ran the city-state. And there were a few of these city-states that were democratized. Everybody who had citizenship participated in the government, making laws and administering the laws and things such as that. These city-states conflicted with each other. They'd have wars with each other, and Sparta and Athens are famous for their wars. And so they were a very disjointed people, and that's why it's a big story when they're able to stand together and fight against the Persians and stave off their invasions. And there was someone who emerges here in the 4th century B.C., B.C. 4th century. His name's Philip. Philip of Macedon. Philip is a Greek name. Okay, and Macedon is the area just north of what you and I call Greece today. We'll look at some maps here in just a moment. And Philip had embraced Greek culture. He loved Greek culture. He loved Greek ways. And his dream was to penetrate down into Greece and unite all the city-states. And he does it. He's the first person to do that, to unite all the city-states. And he creates basically, though they were resistant, one Greek people. And the second thing he planned to do was go after the Persians to drive them out of Asia Minor, what we would call Turkey today, because that area had been heavily influenced by the Greeks for many, many years. But he was assassinated. Don't you hate that when it happens? You've got plans to invade and they assassinate you. But, you know, who would ever want to be a king in ancient times? It's all the time. But anyway, he's assassinated. And up steps his son, Alexander. Alexander had been given a first-class education. How would you like to have Aristotle as your tutor? I'm sure it wasn't cheap. But Aristotle was his teacher. Alexander is given the best of Greek education. As a teenager, he's being groomed as a military commander and is involved in several military exploits and is very successful. He just had it. He was charismatic. He was just naturally a military leader. And so he's already being prime, and he's 20 years old when his dad dies. And he becomes king. And so he solidifies his throne among the Greeks. He organizes an army, and he starts carrying out the plan that his father had. He comes over here and he invades into this Asia Minor area. This is that area that Paul traveled so much in. And he drives the Persians back. They're successful. And it's just like a snowball. Once he starts rolling, he just keeps rolling. And then he comes down the eastern Mediterranean coast all the way to Egypt. And he conquers Egypt. And he drives Persia out of Egypt. And for centuries, Greek-descended people will rule Egypt, like Cleopatra or the Cleopatras. There was more than one. He also set up this city here and moved the capital to it. That's known as Alexandria, Egypt, which still exists today. It becomes a huge center of learning in the ancient times. But as if that's enough, he conquers Asia Minor, Palestine. He leaves Jerusalem alone. And then he takes Egypt. That's a lot. But he goes back up the eastern Mediterranean coast. He engages the Persians here in the upper Mesopotamian area. He defeats Darius III. And Darius III is actually assassinated on the run by one of his lieutenants. And Alexander keeps conquering. He conquers all the way through Mesopotamia, through Persia. And this is where we begin to call this area Mesopotamia, by the way, because it's a Greek term. He pushes through Persia into what we know today as Kashmir and Pakistan. He conquers in those areas. And he has his men really at the Indus River Valley, which is the edge of India. And he's just, his men have had it. He has just overextended himself. And so he begins to backtrack. He has conquered all of this in here. All of it. And when he gets back in here, in Persepolis and Susa, these are capitals of Persia. He had conquered those areas. He's in Babylon. And he is starting to combine his Persian, his Greek people with the Persians. He admired the Persian culture. It's just like civilizations admire Egypt. The Greeks admired Persia, and they had defeated them. But they were big admirers of Persia. He has a lot of his military personnel to marry Persian women. He wants to combine them. He begins to wear Persian clothes. And then at the age of 33, he gets a fever and he dies. I mean, whoever makes a will at 33? Raise your hand. Huh? Okay? Nobody. Okay? So there's no successor. And so his lieutenant generals compete and carve out the territory. Okay? I'm off my notes. I got to go back and see if I've left anything out that's important. I'm just rolling here. And so, but what he does here, he's such a believer. He's been indoctrinated by his father that Greek culture is supreme, all of the architecture and the literature and so forth. And so he begins, he had planted Greek culture all through here. And this is the big story. This is the bottom line. This is the big thing. It's the Greek language. The Greek language becomes dominant. And I've lost my thing, Ken. Maybe I'm out of power or something in it. See if you can hit it and see if it jars it loose, maybe. Can you advance it for me, just one? Just on the laptop probably will do it.
Give me a second. I had a pop-up screen come out of somewhere. I'm going to restart it.
Oh, that's what it was? Okay. All right, we'll get it back up. So, he spreads Greek culture. It intermingles with other cultures, Egypt and Persian culture, etc. But the big thing is that the Greek language is planted and it catches on. And the Greek language becomes, there we go. it becomes the universal language. Now, when I say universal, I don't mean the universe. I don't even mean all of planet Earth. I just mean the Mediterranean region. I mean what we would call today the Middle East. Okay, you have to understand, it's a very different world then. There is no such thing as Islam at this point. Okay, the Arabs are just a Bedouin nomadic people down in the desert. And so Greece has such an impact here. Now, why is the Greek language so important? Well, not long after this, a group of Jewish scholars in Alexandria, Egypt, translate the Old Testament Hebrew scriptures into Greek. We studied about this last summer, the Septuagint. And you know that the New Testament is written in Koine Greek. And so right there, that's telling us something. See what God's doing? He is going to use the Greek language as a channel and as a pathway for his plan and for his message. Okay? So, here's what happens. The generals of Alexander break up his empire, and it's broken up into either four or five. We saw in Daniel 8, there's a prediction of four. At times it breaks down into five, but it's back and forth. Part of it's controlled here, Macedonia, and part of Thrace, and at times this is all one area, and then this Asia Minor area, and then the Ptolemies, and then the Seleucids right there, okay? So, the two that are really important for Bible history are the Ptolemies, which ruled in Egypt. Cleopatra was a Ptolemy. The Ptolemies were Greeks, ethnically, who adopted Egyptian ways and inserted Greek ways and ruled the Egyptian people for centuries. And then the Greek Seleucids over here, based in Syria, controlled Mesopotamia, that upper Palestine area. They controlled all the way through the old Persian kingdom. So they actually had the biggest land area. Well, look who's in the middle between the Ptolemies in Egypt and the Seleucids in Syria. Judea is. And they get squeezed all the time. Judea becomes a political football kicked between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids. And this is where the history gets really, really complex. It gets really, really weedy. And so I'm just giving you the flyover here. And what you have here in Judea is there an element of Jews. They see the success of the Greeks. They see the power of the Greeks here nearby, the Seleucids and the Ptolemies. And they feel like that they need to embrace part of the Greek culture, at least part of the culture. So what happens is, and I have in parentheses Sadducees, but that's sort of with a footnote. This is the party of Jewish people, especially among the leaders and the wealthy, who want to keep their Jewish ways, but combine it with Greek ways. Those are the ancestors, as far as outlook, as the Sadducees. And later on, they'll be called the Sadducees, which are the people who are running the temple and running the priesthood in the New Testament. And then there are Jews that wanted to be separate. They didn't want to compromise with the Greeks. They wanted to drive Greek influence out. And the term Pharisee means separate. These are the ancestors of the Pharisees. See how we're creeping toward the New Testament? And so that was the big divide. It went back for centuries before the New Testament. So that's the dilemma. These powerful Greek kingdoms are trying to rule over Judea, and the Jewish people are having to decide, do we resist them? Do we cooperate with them? Do we become like them? Can we sort of work with them but maintain our Jewish identity? It was a constant battle for them. And that's why you see these issues are very important in the New Testament and even in the Gospels, how Jewish people looked at non-Jewish people. And a lot of times they had terrible attitudes toward non-Jewish people. And Jesus is having to address that. Okay? So the Greeks tied together the Mediterranean world and what we would call the Near East with the Greek language. And it's going to be the Greek language that will be used to formulate the gospel. the gospel records and the New Testament records and the New Testament letters, because that was the universal language. You see right there, that tells us that the New Testament was intended for the broadest audience possible. And that was made possible because of Greek conquest that was so wide in its scope.
Well, I'm reminded of Galatians 4:4, the fullness of time.
Right.
God sent forth the Son, born of a virgin, and that fit just at the right time.
All falling in place. God's using all of these developments. So, that brings us to the Romans, okay? Well, the Romans have been around for a long time. Not quite as long as the Greeks have been, early groups of them. But they'd been around for a while. Slowly, Rome had conquered the area around it, and eventually the Italian peninsula, and eventually the area around the Italian peninsula and parts of North Africa. And then they started conquering toward the east. Slowly from west to east, they began to conquer. And when they got over into Greece, they began to displace those Greek kings and kingdoms that had replaced Alexander's empire. They conquer Macedonia. They, we studied the book of Philippians and Philippi. Philippi was a Roman colony. They had just wiped out, Romans just about wiped out everybody in Philippi and replaced it, Philip Macedon, replaced it with a lot of ex-soldiers, Roman soldiers. And so then they keep pushing into Asia Minor, and then eventually they conquer the Seleucid territories and the Ptolemy territories and that strip of land known as Judea and the areas around that. So by 63 BC, the Romans had subdued Palestine and carved it up into regions, administrative regions, that had to do with the different ethnic groups that were in Palestine, but also in a way they thought was most efficient. And they had either governors over those territories, or they placed local kings, kings that said, "Yes, Rome, we will do your bidding." And this history is very complicated. And there's this man who's an Idumean, and the Idumeans had embraced the Jewish religion, but they were south of Judea. And there was this local Idumean ruler who had taken the place of his father, who curried favor with the Roman authorities, and he became the king of Judea, Galilee, and part of the Transjordan area. And I'm talking here about Herod the Great. So by 40 BC, see how close we are to the birth of Jesus? By 40 BC, Herod, I hate even saying that, the Great, but Herod is ruling over Judea, Galilee, and part of the Transjordan. In other words, where all the Jews are living. And he's ruling when Jesus is born. And he understood the Jewish faith. He was a pagan to the core, but he pretended to be Jewish. He built pagan temples and things such as that. But he's really known for lifting Jerusalem up, refurbishing and expanding the temple. Herod was a fantastic administrator. He stimulated the economy, expanded the trade to Palestine, Galilee, and Judea. And as we said, he made Jerusalem a showcase city. And it grew in population, in size. And of course, he's a brutal authoritarian. A lot of brutal authoritarians are great governors. A lot of brutal, evil, wicked men are very competent. Nebuchadnezzar was. And Herod was. But their character was putrid. So, we got Herod ruling locally, but for the Romans. And the Romans are controlling this area as well. Here in the red is the Roman Empire. Basically, when we get into the 2nd century AD, they're going to be ruling over here in the British Isles. So they're a little bigger, but this is basically during the days of Jesus. And they have this area firm in hand. But I want you to see Palestine, geographically, is what to the Roman Empire? It's a backwater. It's on the edge. It's on the margin. And so Basically, they just wanted it to be controlled. It's not the most important thing to them. But you and I know the most important things that ever happened in the Roman Empire happened there with Jesus. So the Roman Empire bound people together politically and economically. It was a unified system. It was a very robust economic system. They had ups and downs, had famines and times where things got inflated, and et cetera. But the thing that really the Romans did really well, and we've talked about that in other classes, is that they had an incredible transportation and communication system. You could send letters, you could travel swiftly and safely as far as ancient times go. Better than any time in ancient history, ever in ancient history. And so there are these networks for people to move about and to communicate with each other. And after Jesus resurrected, what did he tell his disciples to do? Go into all the world. Go to make disciples of all nations. And now they have the network, the communication and transportation network to do that, as well as to send correspondence with each other. And aren't we so glad they sent that correspondence to each other? And those inspired writers and teachers and apostles were able to send that communication, and then it get dispersed to where they're telling each other, read the letter I sent, like in the book of Colossians, read the letter I sent, to Laodicea, and they're exchanging those letters. That's all made possible by the Roman Empire. Okay, that's an overview of what's happening from the end of the Old Testament into the beginning of the New Testament geographically with these empires and how it affects Bible lands and how it impacts the flow of the biblical narrative. Questions, comments before we do our fun activity? Some of you are thinking, I know what he means by that. Fun for him and not for me. Observations?
Well, even though it is 400 years, it is quite a long time. It's kind of interesting to think about. Alexander took it over. The prominent part of his lifespan took place over the course of 13 years. With that 13 years came the spread of the Greek language, which would present, like you were talking about, the ability to communicate with a universal language. And then in a relatively quick period of time, the Romans took over, which was a fairly quick speed to bring transportation and communication. So even though it was over a long period, it's interesting how quickly God is moving us to prepare for Jesus.
A lot happens. The Romans conquer fairly strategically and step by step. But the amount of change that happens in that time is incredible. What the Romans do, how they change things. Really change a lot. Okay, here's what you're going to do. I've got up on these four tables. I'm going to divide you into four groups. Everybody's got the same thing to do. You have an empire map. Maps that I have showed you on the screen. Maps that you've got in your notes. And yeah, you can use your notes. You can also use your atlas, and I'll throw those page numbers up there. So you've got five empire maps. Ones we've been talking about. I want you to place them in chronological order. And by the way, they're blanked out. And things are blanked out. I don't know how that happened. But I want you to put them in chronological order, left to right. That's how we do things, left to right. Here are the names of the empire, so place the name in the right place. And here's a description about how God used this empire. This one says, God used them to create a connected world via transportation and communication networks. So which empire does that apply to? So you're going to come up here with your group and you just stand around this and work together and put these in the right places. And yes, initially, I'm going to let you use your notes and your atlas, and you get good at it or not. So place the name of the empire on the right map, and then place the corresponding statement of providential purpose with each.